Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode...
Gary Hart ran for president in 1984 and 1988 on a platform of new ideas. Unfortunately, his candidacy self-destructed when he had one of man's oldest ideas. But it is time for someone to pick up the mantle of new ideas, and that person is me, Al Franken.
That voice, of course, is Al Franken in a previous life. It's still a little hard to believe, but 17 years ago, the one-time comedian, famous for his contributions to Saturday Night Live, ran to become a U.S. Senator from Minnesota, and won, barely. At first it appeared he had lost, but after a recount and a protracted legal dispute, Senator Franken went to Washington. And not because he's such a funny guy. As he explains in his new book, Al Franken, Giant of the Senate, the man who spent most of his career cracking jokes always had a serious side and a serious interest in politics. In a recent Seattle visit, Franken shared anecdotes about his life before politics, why he put being funny publicly on hold, his feelings about Senator Ted Cruz and President Donald Trump, and the state of the nation in general. Senator Al Franken spoke with journalist Eli Sanders at Town Hall Seattle on June 16th. Sonia Harris recorded their conversation. Please note, this recording contains some unedited language of an adult nature. We're presenting our broadcast version here. You'll find the full conversation on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Here, Town Hall Seattle's Ware Harmon introduces the event.
Before running for office, Senator Al Franken spent 37 years as a comedy writer, author, and radio talk show host, and has taken part in 7 USO tours, visiting our troops overseas in Bosnia, Kosovo, Iraq, Afghanistan, Kuwait. He was first elected to the United States Senate in 2008 and reelected by a much larger margin in his reelection in 2014. The reason I needed to, it's not in here, but I wanted to say some of these because they're so fun to say, like I said. The reason I had to get my phone is some of his books include I'm Good Enough, I'm Smart Enough, and Doggone It, People Like Me. Daily Affirmations with Stuart Smalley. That's from 92. My favorite is Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations. He has a pipe. He's smoking a pipe on that one. That's from 1996. And then Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them. That's from 2003. His latest book is Al Franken, Giant of the Senate, as I mentioned. He's in conversation tonight with Eli Sanders, who's the associate editor of Seattle's weekly newspaper, The Stranger, and co-host of their Blabbermouth podcast. I think, pro tip, I think Al just appeared on the Blabbermouth podcast, so you'll be able to hear that very soon. He won the Pulitzer Prize, Eli, that is, for feature writing in 2012. Yeah. For his reporting on the murder of Teresa Butts, which was also the subject of his first book, While the City Slept. It's an honor to host both of them tonight on our stage, so please give a warm town hall welcome to Eli Sanders and Senator Al Franken.
Save it for the end. No. No. Save it for the end. What a beautiful place. Gee whiz. Hope they don't do anything to change it.
Never. Never going to happen. Senator Franken, you have done something rare. You have written an actually funny political memoir.
The political memoir is maybe the worst genre in publishing, and I didn't want to write one of those. So, in it, I try to be honest and in a... I try to answer the question that I get asked the most, probably, which is being United States Senator as much fun as working on Saturday Night Live? And the answer, of course, is no. Why would it be? And I also get asked a lot, how did you make the transition? So I explain that. And I also get asked a lot, what's the Senate like? You know, what's it like, especially for someone who didn't come from politics? And then, of course, right now, I'm being asked all the questions that I'm sure people are interested in terms of what's happening in Washington right now. And so.
Well, that's a good list. I was gonna start with the transition. The arc of the story of your book traces your journey from Saturday Night Live to a lot of other things dealing with comedy and political comedy, and then your transition into politics. But the question that you threw out here is a question I think a lot of people have. I had starting the book. Why would you do that? Why would you become a politician?
Well, you know, I always had been political, and the sort of the initial animating issue was civil rights, and my parents and my brother and I would watch the news while we ate dinner on tray. We had dinner on tray tables, and it was good. It wasn't TV dinners, and my mom made a good dinner. And but my dad was a Republican. He was a Jacob Javits Republican. There used to be these things called liberal Republicans, and my dad was one of them. And during the civil rights movement, when demonstrators would have dogs sicked on them or billy clubs or fire hoses put on them, and we'd see that on Cronkite or Huntley Brinkley, which, you know, we kind of trade back and forth, my dad would point to the TV and go, "No Jew can be for that." To me and my brother, no Jew can be for that. And in 64, when Barry Goldwater was the nominee for the Republican Party, my dad switched because Goldwater had voted against the civil rights bill. So this was like the basic lesson that my brother and I learned, which is justice, is about justice. And you know, when LBJ signed the civil rights bill, he turned to a staffer, I think it was Bill Moyers, and said, you know, Democrats have lost the South for a generation. And he was wrong. It's like forever. And we've lost. And so we've lost the South forever, but we gained my dad. and me. And because I love my dad, and so that was, and I love my mom too, but she was a Democrat already, and I had really was kind of identified with him. And so that was the big deal. So I was always very politically minded and public policy minded and issue minded. And doing comedy, when I started doing comedy in high school, I actually started doing it earlier, but when I was doing it with my partner, Tom Davis, in high school, we were doing political satire. And that's what that was the focus of what we did. And when I got to SNL, I wrote a lot of the satire on the show, and or the political sketches. And a lot of them I wrote with Jim Downey, who is a great, hilarious writer, and he is a thoughtful conservative. And we never felt it was a job of the show to have a political point of view, to have a bias. And we wanted to do well-observed satire that didn't punish you for not knowing stuff, but rewarded you for knowing it. So I was very proud of the stuff I did over the years. So I was always interested in that. And when I finally left Saturday Night Live, I wrote a book called Rush Limbaugh's Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations. And boom, people were coming up to me and saying, thank you. Thank you for doing this. And, you know, I kept doing that. And I got did my radio show. And what really motivated me to run for the Senate, and I write about this in the book, is Paul Wellstone. And Paul was... Minnesota senator, amazingly passionate guy who really believed strongly in justice and in, you know, mental health was a huge issue of his that is part of his legacy that I fight for. But he fought for veterans, homeless veterans. He fought for poor people. He did this while he was a professor at Carleton College. He won in 1990 in a campaign that was an amazing campaign. He was an organizer, and he was the guy I did the most fundraising for and the most stuff as a senator for. He died 11 days before the election in 2002, about a week or two before that, I guess about 3 weeks before that, he had voted against going to war in Iraq. And he was one of the very few incumbents who did that. And so it was just tragic when he died. And I'd been campaigning for him. And then Norm Coleman won that race, and a couple months after he was in office, Roll Call did an interview with him, a profile of him, and it had him in his office chewing on an, you know, and gesticulating with an unlit cigar, which I don't know why people would do that, but he just was full of himself. And at one point he said, to be blunt, I'm a 99% improvement over Paul Wellstone. And I read that, and I just went, who's going to beat this guy? And I didn't quite say that. But... and that was the first moment ever I had ever considered running for office. And frankly, I didn't right away think that I was that guy. But the more and more, as time, that was again early 2003, and Franny and I moved back to Minnesota. And just to explore it, and the more I explored it, the more I felt like I enjoyed it. I enjoyed going around to bean feeds and all the DFL stuff, and I took it on.
You write about how the closer you got to declaring your candidacy, and when you finally did declare your candidacy, the more you got the advice, stop being funny. And you had a hard time with this.
Right.
What? What made you stop? Because you did eventually rein it in.
Well,
for a while.
Well, yeah, until now, basically. Basically, I moved back to Minnesota, but even before I moved back, I started talking to Jeff Blodgett, who had been Paul's campaign manager in all three of his Senate campaigns. And I remember sitting down with him, having coffee with him. And politics in Minnesota, especially, is a lot about coffee. I imagine it is here, too. And thanks to you guys, the coffee got better. It used to be weak Lutheran church coffee is the worst coffee in the world. So I remember having coffee with Jeff, and he said, you know, just as an exercise, why don't you write a 5-minute speech without a joke? And I thought to myself, why would anyone do that? I go, why would you want to do that? And everything I'd ever communicated politically had been through humor. And through other stuff, but mainly humor. And so, and then when I finally did announce, right away, everything, they put the Coleman campaign, the Republicans started putting everything I'd ever written or said in comedy through this $15 million machine called the Dehumorizer. And it was built with this very, very sophisticated Israeli technology that could just take the humor out of anything and rob it of its context. If you write satire, you're using things like irony and hyperbole and ambiguity even. And man, oh man, robbed of those things, things can look pretty ugly. And so it was just a nightmare. And I thought that being funny would be an advantage or it'd be good, you know? And I just had to, like, at a certain point, give up on it. I'll give you an example of a dehumorizer and how extreme it could be. I had written an article once about, it doesn't matter what it was about, except it was sort of about technology and me and improvements. Anyway, so I just said, I said, the internet is just a great learning tool for kids. I said, for example, my son last year did a great sixth grade report on bestiality for his class. And he downloaded a lot of great visual aids. And the kids in the class just loved them because, you know, at that age, they're just sponges. So the point of that joke is, hey, maybe you should look at what your kids are looking at. It was kind of a conservative joke. It was like, maybe monitor your kids' downloads. And so anyway, so they turned that into an ad, which was like, Al Franken, jokes about bestiality. And it came from infinity, you know, through your eyeballs, out the back of your brain. And my mother-in-law cried. And she didn't cry because I joked about bestiality. She cried at, what are they doing to my son-in-law? And so it just became, I had to really, and then we also did, we did focus groups early on, and we learned that, man, people in Minnesota, at least then, didn't think being a comedian and, you know, having award-winning five Emmys and all this shit, That didn't mean you were smart, and but they were impressed that I had written books. We found this out in the focus group, and this was so counterintuitive to me. I went to Harvard. I went to Harvard, and so, and I had always thought, just don't mention that. You know, don't mention you went to Harvard. But in the focus groups, they went, oh, he's smart. You know, he must be really smart. So it was play down the comedy. Books are okay. And Harvard's just great. And
I wondered, in the context of this, does it piss you off that there's this other guy out there that really didn't run from his TV persona, and all he had to do is say, I'm like a smart guy. And,
oh, no, or I am a smart guy. Or I'm really smart.
And he just played his TV persona straight into the presidency where you had to spend 6 years.
Well, I write about this. I write about sort of the irony of my race in 2008. And because I had written about bestiality, I was guilty of moral turpitude. But I didn't say I engaged in it. I didn't say that I grabbed animals by the crotch, you know? I didn't brag about that. And so the irony I talk a lot about the irony of the my 2008 and his 2016 runs in those respects. But I also talk about Trump in regard to where we are now as compared to where we were in 2005. And 2005, after this very close election, Bush said he had capital, and Rove talked about a permanent majority for Republicans. And we were organizing, and because of Air America and Media Matters, which was pushing back on the right-wing media and the Center for American Progress and other, we stopped them on Social Security privatization, and you know there was other. And now we have to mobilize against this healthcare. The bill passed in the House, according to somebody who's very very insightful about healthcare. It is mean. This is the only guy in the country who had figured out that healthcare policy was complicated.
No one would have thought.
No one thought that. Man, oh man, it is.
Let's go back to a simpler time for a moment.
Yeah.
So you're getting everything you've said in the past is getting put through the dehumanizer.
Yep.
You're on the campaign trail. You're trying to spin yourself away from your comedic persona, but it's not easy. You've got a lifetime of instinct, plus you think comedy is a good tool for speaking truth to power, for connecting with people.
Right.
And you go out, just in one of many great examples of this you bring up in the book, you go to a town or city to make a speech, and there's a giant German statue.
Oh, Herman the German. New Ulm, Minnesota is this beautiful town in South Central Minnesota, and it's New Ulm. It was founded by Germans, and they have a statue to Arminius, who was a Hun who butchered a lot of Romans in 9 AD in a battle, and it was when Christ was just a tot. It was just a little guy. And so in New Ulm, they have this statue to Arminius, and it's a tall statue, 20 feet tall or 25, and it's on a 75-foot pedestal. And it's in this park. It's quite impressive. And it's called Herman the German. They call him Herman the German. So I'm in New Ulm, and I'm in the park doing a bean feed, actually. We have a group of Democrats, and there's a tracker there. Now, I grew up in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. St. Louis Park is a suburb of Minneapolis. It's the Jewish suburb of Minneapolis. By that, I mean it's about 25 at when I grew up, about 25% Jews, and that's a lot of Jews in Minnesota. That's a shtetl. That's a lot of Jews. So, and Tom Friedman is from there, and the Coen brothers are from there, and Norm Ornstein's from there, and I'm from there. So anyway, but it's called St. Jewish Park in Minnesota. And so I'm a self-respecting comedian, and I'm in the shadow of Herman the German. And of course, I immediately think to myself, you know, I grew up in St. Louis Park, and we had a statue too called Stu the Jew. And but I didn't say it. I didn't say it because I know they would have turned that into, you know, Al Franken blames the people of New Ulm for the Holocaust. So I had exercised a little discipline and didn't do it. And then, like, about a month later, New York Magazine comes to do, like, a profile of me. And at one point, we sit down for an interview, and they go, like, so has there ever been a joke that you thought of that you didn't tell? And I go, oh, yeah, Stu the Jew. And my staff goes, like, why did you do that? And that's when I learned something, which is the pivot. I learned to pivot. Sometimes you, because I had always been taught as a kid from my parents and teachers, you know, if someone asks you a question, answer it and give them a nice, complete answer. And it, with the press, that's the dumbest thing to do. With the press, you're supposed to pivot to what you want to, you know, the message you want to send that day. So, you know, a pivot is like, Norm Coleman's ahead of you by 15 points in the polls. How are you going to convince DFLers, Democratic Farmer Labor Party, DFLers of Minnesota that you're the guy to take them on? And, you know, I would, at first, would answer that question. But then the pivot is, you know, as I travel around Minnesotans don't care about polls. What they care about is their kids' education. What they care about is making sure that they get a world-class health care and that everyone is covered, even if they have pre-existing conditions. And then that's a pivot. That's what you're supposed to do if you're a competent politician. And it took me like a whole, it took me a long time to learn that. And right after the Stew the Jew thing, that was it. I went like, why did I do that? That was stupid. And then so I got another training in pivoting. And then I did my next interview with like a guy who'd interviewed me before for one of the Star Tribune, I think. And so I'm gonna go, okay, I'm gonna pivot. So he asked me a question and I pivoted. And then, and it just, he didn't seem to blink at all. And then he asked me another one and I pivot, even like a more egregious pivot. And then, and nothing, you know, he's fine with that. And then, now I'm going like, this is fun. And he's like, so I'm like wildly pivoting, like just for the sake of seeing how much I can pivot. And at the end of the interview, you know, like a 20-minute interview, he turns to my press secretary and goes, you know, he's getting good. I think he's gonna, I think he's got a shot.
So you pivot all the way to the Democratic nomination when you're in your Senate run. But there is a point where Republicans, in digging up your old jokes and trying to make use of them, find one that you end up having to apologize for against your own instincts.
Well, yeah. I'll tell what this is. At SNL, we would do rewrites late on Thursday night. And it would go to 3 in the morning or something. And it would get pretty dark and raunchy, right? And so, in fact, Christine Zander, I write this in the book, a writer wrote on the show for 7 years, great, hilarious writer. You know, she had a thing when someone would say something raunchy or something, she'd just go, "Dear lawsuit diary." And it just got, you know, and a lot of what you write at that time, you're getting punchy and you're just right. But you're right, you're working. This is work. This is the work that comedy writers do. And there is such a thing, there is an actual phenomenon about late night rewrites. So anyway, Norm Macdonald had this take on Andy Rooney. And it was a similar take that most comedians had on Andy Rooney, which is, and he was amazingly popular and 60 Minutes humorist, and but that the take that most younger comedians had was that his stuff was just banal and irritatingly so. So and Norm did Andy Rooney, and we were rewriting Andy Rooney's sketch that he had done, and he had a great first part of it, and it was just, I cleaned out my desk this week, and I, you know, there are a whole bunch of old letters. Here's one from California. This one's from Illinois. Here's another one from California. This one's from Michigan. Here's another one from California. This one's from California, too. I guess a lot of people live in California. And so we kind of had that germ of it, which is nailing Andy Rooney for... So I go, like, why don't we just turn him into a monster? And so I was like, you know, here's a vial. Oh, here's an empty pill vial of Quaaludes. I slipped some of these into Leslie Stahl's coffee and raped her. Okay, not a joke for the air. It was for the table. There was a New York magazine writer who was there that week, and he captures this, and it's safe. Now, this is like, I didn't intend that to be on the air. Michael Gerson, who I think is a great conservative columnist, writes a collection of stuff of thing, and he said, I wanted to base a sketch on raping Leslie Stahl, you know. So this really caused a crisis, as you can imagine. And I remember talking to Conan O'Brien during this period, and he said, like, if I was on trial and a prosecutor came up to me and said, Mr. O'Brien, have you ever during a 3 a.m. rewrite session made a joke about defiling Lincoln's body immediately after he had been assassinated, I would have to throw myself on the mercy of the court. So I'm trying to, we get in this thing where I'm bleeding delegates because of this, and there's a convention. We really normally bestow there is a primary, but before that there's a convention where you get the DFL endorsement. And I had been way ahead, and now we're bleeding these delegates, and so this was a real crisis. And I write about sort of a, I didn't have a, the way things were going, things happened so fast, I didn't really have time for a dark night of the soul, but I had like a dark hour of the soul. And I was thinking, like, maybe I shouldn't have done this. Maybe, you know, I can, And everyone's saying you should apologize for it. And I'm going like, I don't want to. I was doing my job. And what happened was we changed it to, he put it in Mike Wallace's coffee and took photographs of him nude or something. That was how it ended up. But I'm trying to, and we get to the convention and making this speech to a big crowd of delegates, and this is it. This is sort of it. Everything hung in the balance here. And I had wanted to apologize, but in a way that wasn't selling out, that wasn't dishonest, you know? So I basically, and I got it. I finally found it, and I just said, you know, this is why I'm running, to get health care to every Minnesotan, get our kids a good education, make sure that we have good jobs. But that's not what this camp, this week has been about. And I'm sorry for that. And I really was sincerely sorry for that. When I said, I'm sorry for that, the whole place just went, oh, thank God. They wanted me to apologize. And I wanted to apologize, but I wanted to do it because my campaign manager, Stephanie Shriok, who had just come in, just stepped into the campaign, said, how do you feel about this? And I said, I'm sorry. You know, and so it was, and after that, she said, I never had a base problem after that. I never had a problem. We had all the volunteers we wanted. Because, and that when I said, they all, and then I got a standing ovation. And it was basically, we got, they knew I wanted to do it. They knew I wanted this. And they got the guy they wanted. So that was a moment. And I'm trying to explain sort of, you know, the most important cubic foot of a campaign is inside the candidate's skull. And I kind of try to explain what I was going through in this really weird, unique situation from having been a comedy writer. And I actually started that whole thing out by the guy who's probably my biggest challenger, Mike Cerisi, who is this wildly successful trial lawyer. He dropped out one day, and right before he dropped out, I saw that Elliot Spitzer had been nailed for, you know, going to a prostitute. And I remember just thinking, like, why the hell would he do that? Doesn't he realize all the people that are working for him, that have worked to get him where he is? And that's how I felt. And then this cheer goes up in our office, and Cerisi had dropped out. And everyone's just going nuts, and I'm going like, yeah, that's great. Why did Elliot Spitzer do that? And so the reason I start with that is that I had that moment of like, have I, and you don't know how much Paul Wellstone's memory hung over this race. And so I felt like I was letting Paul down. I felt like maybe I shouldn't have done this, and maybe, but I sucked it up because I asked Al Gore. I emailed Al Gore. I said, I don't know if you know this, but I think sometimes you're unfairly criticized in a campaign. And what advice do you have for me? And he just wrote back, suck it up.
So we're turning past many pages in the book here, but you ultimately win this race.
It's yes.
A big fight. A recount, the closest race in Senate history, is that
by
right?
Percentage basis, yeah. 312 votes out of 2.9 million. I know. You know, I write in the book, Maria Cantwell, I came out here and did a fundraiser for her. I can't remember this, a couple years ago, 4 years, whatever it was. And we're just sitting after, you know, some rich person's house. And afterwards, it's in the San Juan Islands, you know, it's a beautiful, gorgeous thing, and we're just kind of relaxing afterwards, and she started talking about her recount. And she went, oh, God, it was awful. Oh, it was 2 weeks. She goes, how long was yours again? And I went, 8 months. And she goes, oh, my God. I went, you know, it wasn't the Bataan Death March. I mean, you know, at a certain point in that 8 months, it was kind of my new normal. And I won the recount, like, after 2 months. And the rest of the 6 months was just litigation. And Coleman was ahead the morning after, and he said if he were me, he would take a step back and let the healing begin. And then I won the recount, and he just adopted the anti-healing position. and stuck with it for as long as possible.
So you land in the Senate, and you still feel that you need to hold your comedian persona close. You need to prove to Minnesotans that you're
there. Yeah, especially now. I won with such a close margin, and I just wanted to prove to the people of Minnesota that I was there for a serious reason. So I'm not going to be funny. I'm just not funny.
Did you find anyone in the U.S. Senate, any senators who you could actually share a joke with?
No. I mean, no, I meant publicly funny.
Right.
Sense of humor in the Senate is a good thing. And collegiality is a good thing. You can't, it's impossible to get anything done unless your word is good, first of all. But then you just develop friendships and, you know, The Republicans were a little wary of me because I had used so much of my comedy to heap scorn and ridicule on Republicans. But, like, man, right away they figured it out. Like, the first day I got sworn in, Jim DeMint, then South Carolina senator, incredibly conservative, comes up to me and says, how are things on the far left? And I said, they're great. How are things on the nutcase right? And he thought that was hilarious. And a lot of my colleagues have great senses of humor.
You have a story like this about Jeff Sessions.
No.
Before the recent.
Jeff, you know, that's a long story, but Jeff's wife, Mary, knit a baby blanket for my first grandchild. So it's hard to hate a guy whose wife did that, and you don't want to unfairly demonize a guy whose wife knit the blankie for your grandson. So it was good that I've been able to fairly demonize him. But anyway, so... But, you know, they're funny. I mean, Lindsey Graham is hilarious. When he was 16th out of 17 in the last presidential race, I went up to him and I said, Lindsey, if I were voting in the Republican primaries, I'd vote for you. And he said, that's my problem. So most of my colleagues have a sense of humor, and some even have a good sense of humor, but there was one, Tom Coburn, who, you know, most people who can't sing, they can't sing on key, will say I have a bad ear, I can't sing. No one will admit not having a sense of humor, except Tom Coburn. Tom will admit it. And he would say, like, I'd make a joke in, like, a markup or something, or a business meeting, and everyone would laugh, and he'd go, I don't get Al's jokes. And he was, so So anyway, so after enough of this, I went to him and I said to him, Tom, can I take you to breakfast? Because we hadn't been connecting at all. Everything was a misfire. So he said, or can I take you to lunch? I said, and he said, take me to breakfast. I said, okay. So we go to breakfast in the Senate dining room, and it's 8 in the morning, and we're sitting down, and I said, look, for the next 40, 45 minutes, however long this is, let's just have fun, okay? He goes, sure, okay, fun. And and I said, let's talk, you know, we can talk about politics, we can talk about, you know, our families, our careers, whatever. And he goes, but let's have fun. He goes, okay, fun. And I said, okay, now he was known as Dr. No in the Senate because he would put holds on a lot of stuff. He was a big Federalist. He didn't believe the role of the federal government was to do pretty much anything. And he was called Dr. No because he had been an obstetrician gynecologist during his career. So, okay, so he said, fun. So I said, okay, let's talk a career. Let's talk about our previous careers. Let me ask you something. To be a doctor in Oklahoma, do you have to have any formal education? And he says, yes, you've got to go to medical school. And and I said, okay, Tom, that was a joke. And that's what I used to do for my career. I used to do jokes. So he calmed down, and then for the next 40 minutes or so, I taught him what a joke was, what the proper reaction to a joke was. And at the end, later that day, we got a note from him, which was, I really had fun. And so that was that. So then, you know, I observed the protocols of the Senate, and when I had any story that involved a private conversation, I have an exception on this, which is Cruz, Ted Cruz, but I contacted my colleagues, and I just got permission to tell the story. So I call Tom, he's retired in Oklahoma, and I call him up. I go, well, Tom, you remember that breakfast we had? Remember, you know, the joke? I go, like, is it okay if I tell that in my book? And he goes, like, we have a First Amendment. You can say whatever you want. So I said, well, I'm just trying to be collegial. And he, well, you're a gentleman, but you say whatever you want. And so I did. And
all right, people are going to want to ask you questions. Yeah. If you've got questions for Senator Franken, start thinking about them. Start condensing them also, please. But I do want to talk about Ted Cruz since you brought him up. You have come to have a certain feeling for him.
Well, as I say in the book, I say that what you should know about Ted Cruz is that I probably like Ted Cruz more than most of my colleagues like Ted Cruz, and I hate Ted Cruz. And I like him more than most other colleagues like him because he actually has a sense of humor, not a good one, but he has one. And he values comedy, or at least he says he does. So, I mean, it's you never know with this guy. But I write a chapter in which I explain why people don't like him in the Senate. And in the Senate, you really have to, one, your word has to be good. And two, you really have to be collegial. And not, not be a toxic coworker, which he kind of is. He's the guy in the office who microwaves fish, you know? And to get anything done in the Senate, you've got to have some decent relationships with somebody. And he has not really accomplished anything other than really getting the government shut down once.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Senator Al Franken spoke with journalist Eli Sanders at Town Hall Seattle on June 16th. Thanks to Sonia Harris for our recording. Tune in again soon.